and then got into high school, hung up the basketball shoes after eighth grade.
Right.
Tried out for JV basketball, actually, and got cut. And I, when I got cut, I told the coach, I was like, "Coach, come on." And I said, "You mean you don't want a guard that can't dribble and can't shoot? Like, you know, what's not to love about that?" You know.
You're listening to the UGA BCM podcast. Thank you for joining us.
Welcome back to, I don't even know what this is, how many episodes we've had, but it's a lot. It is the sixth episode of, what do we call this? Unscripted. UGA BCM Unscripted. And Carson is not with us today.
Boo! Because,
Tyler, would you like to boo also?
Boo!
Okay, now that you've booed, Carson is hanging out with her international mission board friends, i.e. her missionary friends, in Norway. So y'all just booed the fact that she is hanging out in Norway with missionaries. So good job, guys. All right, I'll also just let y'all know that Tyler is here with us. Not only Ryan, but Tyler. Tyler's our president. And so, Tyler, today is all about you, man.
Woo!
Like, this is Get to Know the President Day. And so, with that said, we're getting here toward the end of the semester, and this is your second term as president, which is a rare fate. A rare feat or accomplishment in BCM life across the state of Georgia. And so, Tyler, let me ask you a question straight out of the gate. What made you decide you'd be willing to be president twice?
Twice. I really enjoyed it the first time.
Okay.
You know, so I wanted to run it back, and and it was great. I think the writing was kind of on the wall when we were changing leadership structures, and I was doing some things with our evangelism, and people were asking me, "You're going to be president, right?" And I was like, "Well, yeah, probably, you know, I guess." Unless Tommy picks somebody else, you know, but...
that is not our process. I do not pick the president. We have a constitution and bylaws.
We do have a constitution and bylaws that I have read and submit to the university every year. So, and we do follow that constitution.
I haven't
you know,
even read those.
And, so, but...
they're worth the paper they're on, right?
They're worth the paper they're on.
That's right. True. So why'd you want to run it back, though?
You know, I really thought that the first year was just getting the ball rolling with the new structure.
And yeah.
Obviously, with the transition in the summer, I saw so much potential. And I do still see potential, honestly. I still feel like we're getting things off the ground in many respects.
Right.
I think there's been a lot of encouraging things this semester that I'm looking forward to seeing how they take shape as we go into the fall and after that. But really, yeah, I just felt like there was business left to be done. There was unfinished business. And I thought that I could do a lot of things to improve and to minister to people this year. So
that's good. That's good. One of the things that I think is really exciting about next year is the number of small group leaders we have that are signed up for next year. We had our meeting a couple weeks ago, and I had people making comments to me saying, "Man, I didn't realize there was that many. Like, how many people were up there in your meeting?" Or who all was that up there, right? And so that's a really, really big sign when you've got that many people invested in what we're doing. I think we're at
17.
Yeah, 17 small groups right now for next year. And that's not including any of our like church small groups that we promote and so forth as well. That's just pure BCM small groups that are going after incoming freshmen and transfers. And so, yeah, we're really excited about that. So I say that to say, Tyler, I think that's a good job. Good job, man. That's a kudos.
I can't take credit for that, but I am excited for those leaders. I mean, 17 small groups across 30 different leaders.
Yes.
That's more than I've ever seen at the BCM. And, of course, you've been here longer than me. But
right.
I'm really excited to get them rolling. And I think particularly for the guys, I mean, there's a lot of guys that stepped out and applied.
Mm-hmm.
Even if it was at, you know, 11:45 right before the application was due, that's okay.
Hey,
that's
okay.
There's no minute like the last minute, right?
And, that's right.
But I'm just particularly thrilled by the fact that there'd be so many guys that are willing to step up, and I'm hoping to be able to challenge them in ways that will really be beneficial for their personal ministry and us as a whole at the BCM. So
yeah, and I think with us being mobile, like We realized this last year that our ground game, our small groups, our ability to create community without having a building to do it within is significant and important. And so seeing this many people be willing to lead in that endeavor, I think says that it at the bare minimum, the students we have that are invested in the ministry are also invested in the vision, and they've bought into what it is that we're trying to do. And so I think that's huge. So, yeah. All right. So here's what we're going to do. Me and Ryan are going to ask you some questions, and we're going to see how this plays out. We're having a little fun.
Crossfire.
Crossfire. So Ryan, Crossfire, that's an old CNN show.
It is.
That is. So when I was a little kid,
the Fox ripped it off and made the Five.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. So when I was a little kid, I would come home from school and I would go to my grandparents' house sometimes. And my pawpaw would, he'd watch the Cubs back when the Cubs didn't have lights and they only played during the day. Mm-hmm. And they were on WGN, right? And he'd watch the Cubs. So I knew when I went to his house, I was going to watch the Cubs when it was sunny outside. And then once it got dark, right before bedtime, it didn't matter what else was on or what I wanted to watch. I was going to sit down on the couch and I was going to watch Crossfire with him. So my love of politics apparently came from that. Right. Mm-hmm. And so I was not an old soul as much as you are, Tyler. but I would bet if you were alive back in the day with the original Crossfire, that would be your thing. I think at 8 o'clock or 9 o'clock at night, you'd be watching it every night.
I had a history teacher in high school that would play clips from old Crossfire.
See, episodes. There you go. There you go.
I was like, yeah, you know, this was you know, when CNN was good. So.
But, oh, gosh. I was going to say back in the day. Wow, that's a hot take. I was going to say that was back in the day where there were not as many news channels, right? And those news channels truly were balanced, where you got perspectives of both sides.
You know, legitimately, CNN did, like, pioneer the 24-hour news thing. Yes. And since they were first to that game, like, they started off, you know, strong and did some good things. And obviously, the landscape has changed a lot with social media nowadays. But
well, I think people forget that I am not teaching government class right now from back in the day. But I think people forget news, like 24-hour news stations, number one, are not 24-hour news, right? There are portions of it that are news. But number two, like, their ultimate job is to make money. And that comes from their sponsors, and that comes from their ads, and that comes from their commercials. And so just inherently and naturally, if a news channel starts to lean one way or the other, it will lean more and more, because then that sells and that's how you make money.
Right.
So
sure.
Yeah. Sure. So, but back in the day, man.
Back in the day,
you heard it from both sides sitting across the table. So we're gonna crossfire you.
It sounds
right?
good.
I guess
sounds
that's good. You said that. I wow, that's that. A tangent. What talk about a BCM podcast topic right there. So Ryan, you're up first. You got anything you want to ask this man? Come on, Ryan.
Oh, I do. We came up with a list of questions last night when we were unloading at Memorial Hall.
Okay.
So, one question for you. Since Tommy brought it up last night in his sermon.
That's good.
What's the role of Israel in Revelation?
Wow. I want to clarify for all my pastors who fall in different perspectives of this. I did not actually take a stance last night when I made a comment half-heartedly as a joke about that. All right? So I just want to clarify that. So we're here for all of you churches that are Baptists and supporting us. So I just want to clarify that. You don't have to answer that, Tyler.
I mean, you know, I've always got things to say. We were talking about this podcast last night, and I didn't know that question was coming. But
oh boy!
But Ryan said, we got questions for you. And I said, well, I've got things to say. I said, I might not have answers, but I've got things to say.
Oh, boy.
and hopefully they'll resemble answers. So, you know, I think there's compelling arguments on both sides of that kind of issue. And I do think that, and Tommy, you echoed this to some extent last night, that it seems to me, and I don't know exactly what this role would be, but it seems to me that God has his hand on the nation of Israel. In a way that's at least somewhat different than other nations.
Uh-huh.
And I can't pinpoint that exactly, because, you know, there's people that would say the same thing about the United States and all that. I'm not going to go down that rabbit hole, but I think that you look back, like, the Six Days War in the 1960s, and how, you know, all these nations came against Israel and they were able to fight him back and all that. And I think that that at least is a sign to me that, okay, well, maybe there is a plan there for Israel in the end times. And so, you know, I would say that the signs kind of point towards there being something there.
Just if you weren't here last night, we weren't here either. We were, on campus last night, not at this office. Right. I just sort of referenced it, like we learned from history. Right. And like, of course, across history, across the landscape of history, people that have risen up against, God's chosen people from the Old Testament and then whatever your eschatological or soteriological views are, you may say differently on New Testament and end time stuff and, you know, more power to you. But we do learn from history, and there's people that rise up against Israel don't really typically end up faring so well, right? And so this all came out of Esther, by the way. It was actually relevant to the passage because we were in Esther chapter 7, and, you know, things didn't turn out so well for Haman, right? And so even with a crazy king in charge. And so, wow, thanks, Ryan. Thanks. Some people may never come back to the BCM now, and some people that never have been may show up.
Yeah.
Right? So, yeah. So that's a great question. Brian, I'm going to give him another one, man. Give him another one.
Oh, what were some of the other questions we talked about last night?
Oh, boy. Now I'm scared.
We talked about some good questions last night.
Yeah.
Ooh. There's one I could ask, but I'm not going to.
I'm probably glad you're not. Hey, y'all realize the hardest part of this job, let me give y'all a secret here. The hardest part of this job is that when you go to a local church, you typically know. So Baptist churches are autonomous, right? And so therefore, they may fall along different spectrums of what's sort of allowed, quote unquote, and that's even a weird word to say because we're autonomous, within Baptist sort of doctrine, right, theology. Even if you were to read the Baptist Faith and Message, there is space within some of those things for different eschatological views, different soteriological views, etc. One church calls a woman in ministry a director of children's ministry. Another church calls a woman in ministry a children's minister, right? Like, there's all these different spectrums, right? Ryan's laughing right now. But there's all these different spectrums. And so one of the things that I have to remind myself, right, that we have to remind ourselves as a BCM, is that our job is to serve all of those churches who are Bible-believing churches. Yep. And so regardless of where they fall within that spectrum. And so I try to do that to my best of my ability. But I also, I try to explain to students and Tyler, I think you and I've had this conversation that sometimes on some of those topics and issues, like particularly when they're like some tertiary issues, like sort of third level issues, those are not issues that you break, community over or break relationship over. And so anyways,
I got a question now.
Yeah, but now Ryan has a question, which is going to throw us back in the fire.
Oh, yeah.
So I just wanted to preface whatever Ryan was going to say with that. We love you guys if you're listening.
This is a good question. This is a good question. This won't divide anybody.
Okay.
So often people have a favorite, like, book of the Bible or a favorite gospel.
Oh, boy, this is good. A favorite gospel, yes.
I'm not going to ask that question. Instead, I'm going to ask what Monroe Harless and I debated probably 3 years ago now. What is the best gospel? if it were possible to rank them.
To have a
big, what is the best gospel?
And when you say gospel, you're not
Matthew,
talking about,
Mark, Luke,
you're
John.
Not talking about the capital T-H-E, capital G-O-S-P-E-L gospel.
No, I'm talking about the four
gospels.
You're
talking gospels. About Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John.
Yes.
Okay.
If you had to rank,
I was gonna
what
say
is the
best gospel is that Jesus died for our sins.
That is true. Right? Yes.
There is
only
one of those, isn't that
fact? All right, if you had to rank one of those four books as the best, not your favorite, but the best.
If you mess this up, you could become heretical right in this moment. So great job. Great job, Ryan.
You know, I think that question's fitting for the time of study I'm doing right now, because I'm reading through all four Gospels at one time. Mm. And I'm just doing it by chapter. So I read Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John chapter 1 like a week ago. And then and I'm on chapter 4 now, so that can tell you that I haven't been reading one a day like I might have intended, but also Luke chapter 1 has like 80 verses, so that slowed me down a bit. I've had to take it in bite-sized chunks. Anyway, you know, I think that my personal favorite for study is Matthew, because I had to do a lot of memory work out of Matthew growing up in a Christian school and everything. We had memory verses every week, and we did a lot of those out of Matthew. A few years ago, I undertook the task of memorizing the Sermon on the Mount, and that's been a tremendous blessing. And so, you know, I've just spent a lot of time in Matthew in my young life up to this point. So I got a lot of good things to say about that. You know, I think that Mark starts a lot of fascinating discussion.
Yes, it does.
I've had some interesting.
Don't tell anyone yet.
Don't tell anyone yet. There you go.
Yes, there you go. Straight out of Mark.
I love it.
Yeah, go ahead. Continue.
but yeah, I've had some good discussions in terms of textual criticism. I really enjoy studying textual criticism and that kind of conversation. And some of those discussions do lead back to some passages in Mark and all that. Obviously, Luke. Yeah, I think I read a stat one time that Luke has like is accountable for the second most amount of words in the New Testament.
Would not surprise me.
And he only has two books.
Yep.
Yes. Right? Luke and Acts. And so but that just goes to show you the thoroughness with which he wrote. And so anyway, obviously he writes is very historically accurate, and scholars have analyzed Luke's writings say that he's up there, you know, with the, you know, first class historians of the time. And so there's a lot of good food for thought there. And then, of course, John, you know, John takes a different...
Completely
different, you know, look at things and whatnot. But I'll never forget me and another guy in high school. And he was, I don't really know when he got saved exactly, but I think he was a new believer at the time. And he was reading through John, and we would have discussions in our Bible classes, and the insights that he was able to bring as a new believer coming from the book of John were really encouraging to me, and showed me even in 10th grade that, oh, wow, you know, there's lots of great stuff here in this gospel for the new believer. So, you know, it's a very season of life thing. And I mean, of course, each gospel, every word in them is good for every season of life, right? Mm-hmm. But there's been particular moments in my life where each of the four gospels have spoken into in a unique way, and I'm grateful for that. So
that was an incredibly political way to not answer the question.
You did not answer the question. I'll answer the question. I'll answer the question with two answers. Number one, I would say that the best gospel is whichever one you're reading. Mm. Right? So there you go. So
well, I'm reading all four of them right now. Okay. So I talked about all four of them.
You did. Right? Number two, I would say that my favorite gospel is a book that I'm holding in my hand right now. I just pulled off of my bookshelf.
You did.
And it is called A Harmony of the Gospels. Mm. And it goes all the way from the first chapter of each gospel through the end of each gospel. And it lays out the story of Jesus, all the way from John the Baptist to Jesus. And it does it chronologically. And then it also has some parallel, what do you call those? Not rows, columns. Yeah, columns, yep. Where that when a gospel is telling the same story, you can read those side by side.
Yep.
And then at the end, there are seven essays, right?
Yeah.
That Robert L. Thomas and Stanley N. Gundry apparently have written. They are academic essays, but referencing why it's important to harmonize the gospels.
Yep.
Does some source criticism as well, and then just looks at the history of it and so forth. So anyways, I would say whichever one you're reading, but I do think it is important, like the fact that you're reading all four at the same time. I think that's significant because the Gospels are telling the same story,
mm-hmm.
right? But from
with four different
perspectives and purposes.
Yeah.
So, you know, different perspectives and purposes. So,
yeah. Anyways, I had a professor. Well, let me backtrack. 3 years ago when Monroe and I debated this, she said that Mark was the best gospel. And I told her she was flat out wrong. I said that John was the best gospel.
Oh, fun.
I still believe John's the best gospel. I think that's largely influenced by the fact by at church we've been going through the book of John on Sunday mornings for almost 2 years now.
Right.
So that's definitely why I'm saying that now.
I mean, John does have John 3:16.
Yeah, it does. It does. Luke doesn't have anything on that. Yeah. But I had a professor in college, Dr. Coppins. He was incredible. He was really, really good. And I took a class of his called The Gospels. And it was exactly what that book that you're holding was. But it was just Matthew, Mark, and Luke. He had an entirely different class that I took that was just on John.
Right.
That was also very good. But in it, we just talked about the different Gospels and their different purposes and their different objectives.
Yeah.
And when I had that initial debate with Monroe, I had not taken those classes, and so I was very naive. Mm-hmm. Definitely thought I was right, just in, you know, oh, John's the best Gospel. None of the other ones can compare. After taking that class, I grew in appreciation for all of them and what they are trying to do.
Yeah. That's good.
I also just love the fact that Mark, every time Jesus does something, he's like, "Hey, shut up!
Yeah.
Don't do anything. Hey, don't say anything."
Right.
But then they tell even more people anyways. Yeah, so
like, the time is not here yet. Hold tight. It's coming. It's coming. I can't help myself. Right. Can't help myself. I got to tell somebody. Yeah, yeah. No, that's good. That's good. All right. So Tyler, here we go. We're getting off of this whole like, I don't know what we just talked about. Honest, I do know what we just talked about, but I don't remember what we talked about before that. It was some, he was trying to ask you eschatological views of Israel. That's exciting, right? So anyways, hey, tell us about yourself. Like, I don't know if everybody knows, like, where are you from, family, all that good stuff.
Well, anybody that talks to me for longer than 10 seconds has probably heard this joke, and so I'll repeat it in this context for maybe the 462nd time. But so I'm from Asheville, North Carolina, and I always say this joke. I say, you know, you might be surprised to learn when you hear my accent that I'm from a state with North in its name.
That's true.
Right?
Yes.
And it's usually worth about 1.5 laughs, right, on an introduction. And that's good enough for me, right?
So
I'm good with just a half a laugh, to be honest with you. So I'm from Asheville, North Carolina. My parents graduated from UGA. And they're from Commerce and Livonia, wonderful northeast Georgian towns. And they moved to North Carolina before I was born. And because apparently they took a trip out to Colorado and went skiing and liked the mountains out there. They said, oh, we'd like to live in the mountains, but we want to move to Colorado. So they moved to North Carolina. And now Asheville's becoming like Colorado in many respects. But that's a discussion for another time, I suppose. So grew up there and went to two different Christian schools. I went to Veritas Christian Academy in elementary school, and it was a rigorous elementary school. I'm not gonna lie, like they put us to work, and I'm thankful they did because I learned a lot. A lot of students complained about it, but I was too afraid to complain because my parents were spending tuition money for me to go there. And I thought it was probably a bad idea for me to complain. And I genuinely enjoyed it too.
Right.
So that was good. I'm thankful for that. We were talking about politics earlier. This is not a political statement at all, actually, but in my second grade, I had a teacher named, Miss Clinton, and this student, like the teacher's aide, was a lady named Miss Gore, and so I just thought that was
no hilarious. Way. Are you serious?
I had Clinton and Gore as
in what year was this?
Second grade, what like year? 2000 and I don't know, 10, 11, 12.
Okay,
I don't know.
The fact that you even knew enough about like that to know that was hilarious tripped me out.
Well, I didn't at the time, but my parents were like, "Oh, you got Clinton and Gore," and I was like, "What's that?" And then they proceeded to give me
then they gave you the history.
History lesson.
Yes.
So. Anyway, so grew up going to those Christian schools. I transferred to Asheville Christian County, which is a bigger Christian school because they had a baseball team. And so looking forward going into middle and high school, I'm like, I want to play baseball. But my parents wanted to keep me in a private school. So we went to Asheville Christian Academy. That was really great. Really came out of a shell there, honestly. Like, I was super quiet in elementary school, like big-time rule follower, you know, like wanted to get all those gold stars on the report card.
Oh, yeah.
And how you do that in elementary schools is, like, shut up and don't say anything.
Right, right.
Which, if you're a guy, like, really makes you stand out, because most guys just, you know, they don't have that kind of self-control in elementary school. And so, anyway. But in middle school, and I got to a new environment and really kind of blossomed there, if you will. And
right.
I'll never forget that I gave a bit of a presentation, if you will, in sixth grade. So my Bible class was tasked with, like, leading chapel that week. And so I devised this, like, news show kind of theme to the thing, and I was going to host it, you know. And I just remember having an absolute blast up there, like, hosting the show and in front of the middle school, and people say, oh, like, you know, you spoke really well, and you're in sixth grade and all that kind of stuff. And so I'll never forget, like, feeling really comfortable in front of an audience for the first time.
Right.
In sixth grade. And you know, I think the Lord has used that many times subsequently, but anyhow, so that was good. And then got into high school, hung up the basketball shoes after eighth grade.
Right.
Tried out for JV basketball, actually. And got cut. And when I got cut,
I
told the coach, I was like, coach, come on. And I said, you mean you don't want a guard that can't dribble and can't shoot? Like, you know, what's not to love about that? You know?
Oh,
and,
boy.
So that was the end of the basketball career, which was fine. I stopped growing. And so, you know, rubber hit the road, reality
right,
struck,
right.
You know, thankfully baseball, you can get away with being a little bit smaller and still being good. And so played baseball through my high school career.
Nice.
And
any siblings?
Enjoyed no siblings, just me and the dog.
You and the dog.
So I have a story about my first dog, which I'm not going to tell in this context. But but anyway, but me and
we
that
have,
dog,
we have heard
we're
this
really
story.
Close.
Yeah, we have heard this story.
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah. But when I would stay at home, so my parents would go to work and they'd leave me at the house, and I would ask for chores to do.
Right.
Like, people thought I was crazy, but I was bored.
Yeah.
I couldn't drive, and I was like, please, like, give me stuff to do.
Right.
Like, let me mow the yard twice or something, or
right,
all that kind of stuff. So my parents, I'm sure, were thankful for that. And because I like to think I got some stuff done around
yeah,
the house.
Yeah.
And took the dog on walks. So we had a great time. You know, I'm glad I was an only child. I really am. I'm sure there's people out there with, like, seven siblings, and they're probably like, yeah, you are, because you get all your parents' resources concentrated on you.
Right, right. So here's the question. Are you going to only have one child?
I mean, I can't control that.
Wow.
I could if I wanted to. My theological opinions restrict me from controlling that.
Right? Okay, okay. Do you want to only have one child?
No, I want to have more than one.
You want to have a whole baseball team?
Not, I don't know about that, but
okay, maybe that's a good answer. I had a student one time that said he did.
And, a baseball team.
Was that yeah, student Philip Rivers?
No, it was not.
Maybe a basketball team or like a cornhole team.
Yeah, he wanted to have his own baseball team. If he's listening to this, he's going to kill me, so I'm not going to call out his name. But he wanted to have his own baseball team and basically his own, like, academy at his house, right? You know what I mean? Like, it was that kind of thing. And so I explained to him, I was like, at what point in a relationship do you tell a girl this, right? Like, at what point do you let the cat out of the bag that, hey, I want to have nine children, right? And I want you to stay at home and teach them all. And so I'm not sure how that went for him.
But if he's going to have a whole baseball team, shouldn't he have more than nine? You can't survive only off one pitcher.
That is a good point.
You teach them all the pitch.
Yeah.
You teach them all the pitch.
Right,
they're literally teaching all the pitch, and then it pans out from there. So you're okay with a basketball team?
I'm okay with a basketball team.
Then they can live out your dream that ended in eighth grade.
That's true. I better marry somebody that's tall, because my 5'8" jeans, you know, aren't really gonna pass them, set them up for much basketball success.
That's a good point. But, it depends on what country they live in. there are some countries where people are typically shorter.
That's
right?
True.
You pick one of those, you go be a missionary there, and
yeah,
then they could be all American. Well, it wouldn't be all American if it wasn't in the United States.
Well, yeah,
they could be all something.
We played some basketball in Guatemala. They loved basketball in Guatemala.
They did.
And I was probably taller than the average guy down there. So,
yes, that's right.
It's true.
And so anyway,
I have a question.
Yeah, go
so,
fire away, Ryan.
You said you went to Asheville Christian Academy. You preached chapel at Asheville Christian Academy, right? What did you preach on?
Oh, this is great. I preached on 2 Chronicles 20.
Come on.
And Jehoshaphat, and I walked through that passage and basically looked at how Jehoshaphat responded to different spiritual challenges that he was faced with. And I thought it was really good. You know, I think that when you go to preach and you pick a story or a book that's kind of unusual, you know, it gets people's attention. And so I walked up there and said, hey, I'm preaching out of 2 Chronicles. And people are like looking for their, you know, the indexes in the front of the Bible, right? But it's a really great story. And I actually think there's a lot we can learn from both the books of the Chronicles are two of my favorite books of the Bible. I started working on this like 3 years ago, and it's taken a 3-year hiatus in some respects. But I love to one day kind of develop a study looking at the different figures in the Chronicles and looking at some typology that's in there and saying like, okay, you know, how can we take the lessons that we can learn from these kings and apply them to our life and in the context of Christ and everything. So
this man knows what typology is. He hadn't even been to seminary, huh?
We talked about typology in high school.
Actually. Oh, did y'all really?
You went to Christian school.
That's true.
Yeah. So and most people like they hated Bible class and all that kind of stuff.
Old types and anti-types. Yeah,
it's good.
Man, yeah.
It's good. We talked about Christology and which is a subset of typology.
That's right. Yes.
Theophanies. We talked about that. It was good.
Speaking of typology. Since Ryan tried to pigeonhole you on some eschatology earlier, one of my favorite classes in seminary was by a professor, and I just lost his name. This is terrible. This is where Unscripted messes you up. I'll think of it later, probably. But he wrote a book on typology, and he wrote it on basically reading Revelation through the lens, regardless of what you claim your eschatology is, but reading it through the lens of typology. And then also he spent a significant amount of time talking about partial fulfillment and like total fulfillment, like full fulfillment or whatever. And so anyways, when you begin to read the Bible through the lens of typology, like that is crazy, particularly when you do it through the lens of looking at what it tells us about Christ, right, through Christology. So anyways, that's a good word.
That's one of the things I'm really grateful for. I have a heart for Christian education because I've seen how it's developed my thoughts.
Yeah.
And there were some particular teachers that really spoke into my life and in certain times, and I'm grateful for that. And that's part of one of the reasons I explained that about typology. Like, that's an English concept, if you will, that you can, you know, use to analyze secular reading, and we did. And you think about, different types in historical literature. It's like, okay, well, we can apply this to the Bible too. And so I think that a good Christian education seeks to harmonize all those things and says, okay, you know, how can we take these concepts that we're learning in an English class or a math class and look at what it says about who God is.
Yeah.
You know, and look at what it says about the gospel ultimately.
Yeah, that's good.
And I was blessed with some teachers that were able to articulate that.
That's good.
And it did a lot for my faith. It did a lot for my learning. Mm-hmm. And so that's where my passion for Christian education kind of comes from, because I seen what it did for me. So
that's cool.
Yeah.
Well, once you write that book, let me know. I might write the little preface for you or whatever if you want me to. Right?
Forward.
The forward. That's what that thing's called. Can you tell I didn't teach English? Right? Yeah.
I would write.
You'd write the preface. I'd write the forward. That's what I meant.
I'll write the review on the back of the book that nobody reads.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
I finally got to the end.
Like, who's this Ryan Perry guy?
We'll get in on it.
Yeah.
It'll be good.
So, hey, we've got a college pastor in town that's written a couple of books now.
We do.
Michael that's Fry.
Yeah.
He referenced that on Sunday. He was preaching. He's like, I know a guy that wrote a book recently about wisdom.
Yeah.
And we all started laughing.
Yes, that's right.
He was talking about himself. So he M.T. Fry.
M.T. Yeah. Fry.
Oh, yeah.
If you're looking, hey, seriously, like if you're looking for like a kind of simple devotional book, you have to understand the perspective that he's writing it from. Because it truly is a book that he wants to be able to put into the hands of unbelievers and get them started on some sort of journey, and begin asking questions. But he takes Proverbs, right? And he calls it, what's he call it? The manual.
The manual for gaining wisdom.
The manual for gaining wisdom. The manual for gaining wisdom.
Yep.
Because he's also created this thing called the mantle, right? Where it's like, you know, be a man.
Be a man.
But be God's man. And so
we'll link the book in this in the episode description of the episode.
That's great. Yeah, we'll link the book. You can get it on Amazon. I have one that doesn't have page numbers.
Because
the original print did not have page numbers, and I've got that one.
Let's go.
Cool.
There you go.
Yeah. So then they fixed it.
Yeah, that'll sell for big money on the aftermarket, you know.
That's right.
The manual for gaining wisdom without page numbers. Like,
that's right. Coming when M.T. Fry becomes a famous writer, I will say, I know him as Michael, right? Yep. And I have his first book with no page numbers.
I know what the M.T. stands for.
That's right. Yep. That's right. No, that's a good word. So, all right. So what else you got for us? This is your last shot, last word of the day. Well, what do we got? It's about that time, isn't it?
Yeah.
Ryan's got another question.
So I know how long the YouTube video is because I watched it, but how long did the 20 kill challenge in Fortnite take you?
Oh my goodness. I love that you asked about that. You know, COVID brought out the best and worst in a lot of us, and I don't know if you consider me playing Fortnite. It's certainly not the best, that's for sure.
That YouTube channel with the Fortnite, yeah, it was definitely the worst.
Yeah,
it was okay. It's all right.
So I have matured since then, yes. But you know, my friends, I never owned like a gaming console growing up, never really played video games until Fortnite. And so it was just a good way to hang out, and I like to talk, and so it's like, you know, I can spend time with my friends just virtually, you know. But I was always like terrible at the game,
mm-hmm.
So I thought, well, you know, maybe I could turn this into something that can, you know, be a little humorous. And so I did, and so made several YouTube videos. But one of them was at the end of 2020, I did something called the 20 Limbs Challenge. I wanted to see how many games it took me to get 20 kills, and you know, for the new year, and it was going to be great, and all that kind of stuff. And I had fun with the editing. But anyway, it ended up taking me 20 games, which was really bad because...
it took you 20 games? Yeah. Playing solo or whatever,
Solo. And here's the deal. I never played solos. I only played with my friends.
Right.
So my skill-based matchmaking for solos was terrible.
Yeah.
Like, I was playing, like, I don't know how many people were actually real that I was playing against.
Right.
Like, I very legitimately could have died to the AI control characters because I was not good. But anyway, it ended up taking me 20 games, and there's lots of memorable moments from those videos. I had a blast editing these videos with VideoPad. Like, I found a company in Australia that had a video editor for free.
Right.
That had more functionality than other editors did, and so I had a great time with that. And the Fortnite. Yeah, you know, I think I still have my YouTube channel linked to my Instagram bio.
Oh boy,
which is
I just Googled it. I think that's totally fair. Yeah.
Well, I just find it, I should probably like take that down, but I also haven't changed my Instagram bio in years. But
you know, the Googling
transparency,
Googling you, Tyler, is something that our exec did when you applied for leadership.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Yes, and so
we did.
Yes. One of our females at the time did. I was sent a message and I was told, you need to check this video out. This kid can preach. And, at that point I went and found like your video.
Mm.
So I don't want to name who it was. But one of our female exec members at that time, and by the way, you know, when you apply for leadership, sometimes we do stalk you on social media and the internet just to make sure that you're not doing anything stupid, right?
Yeah, live above reproach.
And so thankfully, they did not somehow find your gaming videos, but instead they found a link to the sermon that you had preached in chapel in high school. And so they sent it to me and I was like, man, yeah, this dude's a good communicator. Look at this. This is crazy. And so I just want you to know, it was not your Fortnite videos that put you on the path to be where you are currently as
president.
That
is true. You know,
it was your chapel sermon that put you on that path.
I joke around about my YouTube link being in my Instagram bio, but I know it's there, and I do leave it there with the intention because I know that sermon's on there. And I'm grateful when I've gone back to visit ACA, you know, just to see some teachers and stuff, and I went back to help them repair some things after Helene hit. And I still get good words about that sermon that I preached, you know, 3 years ago. So I think it was able to speak into the lives of a lot of people. And in fact, we had there's a guy that came down, was a new student this year at UGA, and he went to my high school. Didn't know, I just met him at move-in. Like,
wow.
Didn't even know he was coming at all.
Wow, that's cool.
He was like, oh, are you Tyler? And I was like, yeah, I am, but I don't remember who you are. Like, I'm sorry, you know. He's like, oh, I went to your school. I remember you preaching, you know, 3 years ago. And anyway, people do, I'm thankful they remember that.
That's awesome.
You know, it's not about me or anything, but I think that I was able to to really speak into a lot of people's hearts in that moment.
Cool. All right, last words, Tyler. You got any last words? Not that, like, I mean,
any last words? That sounds terrible.
Last words for this podcast. This is your chance. This is it right now.
You know, I don't think so, but I'm going to return a question. Y'all have been asking me questions all day long, so I'm going to return a question.
This is dangerous.
Okay.
I'm going to ask Tommy a question, then I'm going to ask you a question, Ryan.
Okay. Because
I don't think Ryan would be qualified to answer this question, but if you have...
So,
probably won't be.
So, Tommy.
Yes.
What is the best way to break in a baseball glove? Your son comes home with an A2000... That was the glove that I used.
I could have answered this like 5 years ago.
Yeah.
Are you, don't tell me you're a glove steamer guy.
No, I'm not a glove steamer guy. So particularly, so like Brady's an infielder, Cooper's an outfielder, so it's a little different. But if you break a glove in wrong out of the gate, it gets too soft too fast.
Correct.
Right? And then it ends up being flimsy later,
especially if you're an infielder.
As an infielder, you don't want the pinky or the thumb like bending when a line drive hits it, you know, over the course of time. And so honestly we've got one of those hammers, like the little wooden mallets, and so we'll beat the fool out of that thing with a wooden mallet. And then I really think the best way to break them in so that you can keep the shape you want it is really by just throwing with it.
Yeah.
And over the course of time, throwing with it. You know, Brady usually, and Cooper with his outfield glove that he got this past year, Cooper's finally got it in his hands big enough to make the jump to like the A2000 outfield glove, right? And so it really was for them just them continually squeezing it to the shape that we actually needed and wanted so it didn't become a pancake, right? And then using the mallet. And then basically just playing catch with it. So I think that's the best way. That's the longest way. Now Cooper is crazy. Like my son Cooper, like he's kind of nuts. And so Cooper broke in his outfield glove literally in like a few hours because he walked around with the mallet and with a baseball, just folding it, like bending it the way he needed it, like closing it the way, just beating the fool out of that thing. And so literally in like a few hours, he goes outside to throw with Brady and he comes back in. He's like, "Dad, it's broke in. I'm ready to use it." I'm like, "There's no way, son. You got that like 6 hours ago." He's like, "No, it's ready. It's ready." I'm like, "Give it to me." And he's left-handed. So like when I put it on my right hand and squeezed it, I was like, "Oh, okay. Well, I guess it's ready." So if you need a glove broke in, just bring it to Cooper. Because when he focuses on something, he doesn't, like, he's just, like, zoomed in.
I like it.
And, man, he beat the fool out of that thing, and it broke in.
That's awesome.
So there you go.
That's good.
With a mallet and with a baseball.
With a mallet and baseball. Yeah.
Don't put it under your bed. Don't have your dad ride over it. With a
F-150.
Yeah. Don't, if you're going to put a ball in it and, like, kind of keep it tied, you better shape it right, right? Because otherwise, putting the ball in it and tying it just makes it flat steel with a little bump in there, right? I'm not a big fan on sticking them in water. I've heard some people doing that, right? The other thing is...
Put them in the oven? Have you seen...
I've heard of that, yes. The other thing is like, it depends on the type of glove. Mizunos are usually softer anyways.
Yeah.
So, like, I always use, when I caught, I used a Mizuno mitt back in the day, and I did it because I didn't really have to do anything to it to break it in. And I actually liked that kind of softer feel. But I don't know. The problem is that they didn't usually last as long either, because they were softer. So yeah, that's a great random non-BCM question.
I love that.
There we go. There we go. Good. All right. So for all of our college students that are going to buy gloves for intramural softball, right? There you go, buddy.
Man, playoffs are about to start.
Yeah. If you're waiting to this point to get a glove, you're out of luck.
That's true. Yeah. That's true.
All right, Ryan's question. Here we go.
Ryan, okay, you're up. I've heard that you've been on quite the immaculate grid grind lately.
Oh, I have. I have. Right? I'm not done today's yet, but I have.
So tell me what your greatest immaculate grid pick of all time has ever been. And let me explain this real quick. So immaculate grid, you basically are given two criteria, and you have to pick an athlete that meets both of those criteria. From it could be a there they have immaculate grids for baseball, basketball, football, probably other categories too. So Ryan, your greatest pick of all time, what you got? What comes to mind?
See, I have a bunch of these screenshots, so this is so we can actually like.
Hold on, you have screenshots?
Yeah, because so I wow. So right now I'm in a group chat with Carson Mitchell, Caleb Court, and Jack Ramsey, and every day we do as many immaculate grids as we can, like the football, baseball, basketball.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I usually don't do the baseball one as much unless right. the Braves are on there or it's statistically based because right. I don't know professional baseball like that, and so we send each other our scores and then we screenshot like our grids and what we ended
this
up putting.
Is great.
Are we talking overall grid or individual pull?
No, the individual. I want one athlete okay. with like a crazy low percentage.
Okay.
That I've never heard of before.
Cue the Jeopardy music. Let me go through
oh, boy.
These screenshots real quick.
So, I feel like that I played baseball with a kid in high school that I'm still friends with him on Facebook and such. I'm going to have to reach out to Brad Giles, and I'm going to have to ask him, do you play Immaculate Grid? Because if he doesn't, like he ended up becoming an English teacher, and now he's actually a pastor. If he doesn't, I'm going to be highly disappointed because that man was an encyclopedia of sports facts, particularly baseball facts, right? So if he was answering this question right now, I'm telling you, it would be – you'd just be amazed. Like, you would absolutely be amazed.
My dad gave me a book one time when I was maybe 10 or 11, I'm not sure, but it was called The World's Book of Useless Information.
Right.
And so I read through that entire book, and it was just like lines of random facts, you know. And he also gave me a book called 1,200 Words to Make You Sound Smart because, you know, if you hear me talk any length of time, you'll know that I'm a big fan of vocabulary.
This makes so much sense right now, Tyler.
And so I really enjoy being, you know, pulling some unusual words out of the bag.
Yeah.
Just broadening the vocabulary a little bit. And I don't do it for the purpose of sounding smart. I genuinely have a lot of fun doing it. But
right.
I suppose it has the maybe the unintended consequence of you know, communicating at a higher intelligence.
Here's the question that I would ask for you, Tyler. Do you do like a word of the day? Like, do you have like a word of the day, like a vocabulary word of the day or word of the week?
You know, there have been times where I've done
yes,
that.
Yes.
You know, every now and then I'll see a word and it's just so good. I'm like, I have to work this into a conversation.
Right.
And I'll try to, you know, find places to,
right.
to work it in. But you know, I need to make that more of a habit maybe, you know.
I got to tell you, I am watching Ryan right now scrolling through screenshots on his computer, and I feel like it's going to take him 45 minutes to answer this question, but I feel like it's going to be really good when he gives us an answer.
Oh, I'm going
to I also
really
feel like
answer.
The fact that he is taking this long to scroll tells us.
Oh, okay. Okay, I got it.
What's
I got
it called?
Immaculate grid. Okay.
Ryan, this may be something like, are you addicted to this, Ryan?
So I was for...
Do we need to have an intervention right now, Ryan?
Last summer, I would say yes. I spent an unhealthy amount of time doing this last summer before work. But recently, we've gotten back into it since Carson and Jack and I would always send these to each other. And Carson has a ridiculous amount of knowledge about the NFL and like where people have been. So like he could tell you some polls that are like, what the heck? I don't even know.
Right.
This is not like my greatest, like, you know, greatest poll of all time, but my favorite poll of all time because nobody else knows about it. It is personal to me and nobody else is ever going to think of this is on the football grid.
Uh-huh.
When it's Saints and Super Bowl champ, which happens more often than you would think. So all you have to do is pick one player that has won a Super Bowl on the New Orleans Saints.
Right.
So a bunch of people are going to put Drew Brees, right? That's going to be a big number one
yeah.
answer. My number one answer every single time, which the last time I did it resulted in a 0.09%, is John Stinchcomb. He was one of their offensive linemen, and the only reason I know that is because I went to school in middle school and high school with his nephew.
Right.
And all his nephew, his name was Connor Grimes. He was a great guy. But all he would talk about was the fact that his uncle won a Super Bowl with Drew Brees. And I'm like, no, he did not. You're lying. You're making this up. And I thought he was lying until John Stinchcomb came and spoke at FCA in middle school. So the first time I played Immaculate Grid that it ever came up of Saints with Super Bowl champ, I'm like, I'm going to beat Carson today. And I beat Carson that day. And he's like,
you have John Stinchcomb.
Because I have John Stinchcomb and he does not.
That is awesome. That's a good one. That's a good one.
Yeah.
Well, that's a great place to end. Because the Stinchcombs have a significant history here at the University of Georgia.
They do.
And so what better place to end than talking about a family, literally, that has a great history here at UGA. And so with that said, we'll catch you next time. Go Dawgs, and see you next Monday night.